David Jenkins for the Gen Re Entities. I'd like to introduce to the court Mr. Fred Rowley from Munger, Tolles, and Olson. Mr. Rowley represents the Gen Re Entities, but will be making the argument on behalf of all the third-party defendants in Appeal Number 451, that is, the Gen Re Entities, the Marsh Entities, and the Ace Entities.
Welcome to the court.
Thank you.
Ms. German?
Good afternoon, Justice Holland, Justice Berger, Justice Jacobs, Shannon German of Morris Nichols, Arshin Tunnel, for Appellee American International Group. With me today are Daniel LaFell of Paul Weiss, Rifkind, Wharton, and Garrison in New York, and John DeTomo with the Wilmington office of Paul Weiss. Mr. LaFell has been admitted pro hoc vice, and with the court's permission, will make today's argument.
Thank you. Welcome to the court.
Thank you.
Good afternoon. On behalf of Hank Greenberg, I'm Michelle Davis with Skadden Arps in Delaware. May I introduce the court to John Gardner of our New York office, who will be presenting argument today and has been admitted pro hac vice.
Thank you. Welcome to court.
Good afternoon. May it please the court, Carmela Keener of Rosenthal, Monheit & Gaudis, on behalf of the appellant Donald Fragnoli in Appeal Number 574-2009. I'd like to introduce to the court Mr. Frank DePrima. Mr. DePrima has been admitted pro hoc vice and will make the presentation today on behalf of this appellant.
Thank you. Welcome to the court.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Good afternoon, Mr. Grant.
Good afternoon, Your Honors. May it please the court. The decision below by the Vice Chancellor will basically eliminate aiding and abetting a breach of fiduciary duty. And let me explain why. The type of harm that is generally caused by faithless fiduciaries is to the corporation, and therefore its derivative, not direct. Aiding and abetting requires a wrongdoing, a breach by the fiduciary. But if you believe what the defendants here claim, that breach would preclude liability under in pari delicto. So in order to state your prima facie case, you'd also have to state an absolute defense if they're right. And yet there are a host of Delaware cases cited on page 14 of our opening brief which uphold liability for aiding and abetting a breach of fiduciary duty. Moreover, the Court of Chancery's opinion would overturn Laventhal, Kirkstein, Horwath, and Horwath versus Tuckman, which holds that, quote, persons who knowingly join a fiduciary in an enterprise which constitutes a breach of his fiduciary duty of trust and jointly and severally liable for any injury which results. So how can that aider and abettor be jointly and severally liable if in pari delicto is going to be considered as a defense? Because by definition, if you say he breached the faithless fiduciary breached his fiduciary duty, you've given them a perfect defense. Now, maybe aiding and abetting doesn't exist in Delaware, but there seems to be a number of cases, both of this court and throughout Chancery Court history, that indicate that it does. So either aiding and abetting exists, or in pari delicto exists, but they can't exist together. Now, let me turn now to the policy issue, because it seems to me that it's very bad policy to which the court below espoused. And I know we focused on giving more, treating corporations better than treating individuals. And in the last argument, even that was brought up. But I think what the Vice Chancellor did was he missed something. The Vice Chancellor explains that there's no utility to resolving fault between wrongdoers. Let each company's shareholders sue their own faithless fiduciaries, and that'll take care of it, not to worry. And in footnote 21, he explains his reasoning and quotes the following: by closing the doors to a plaintiff that is in pari delicto, courts are deterring illegal conduct. Close quote. But what does the Vice Chancellor miss? What if the co-conspirator was an individual? Now, let's take a specific example here. You have Hank Greenberg. Okay, he's running AIG. Very wealthy man. He's got some very wealthy friends. Instead of going to Marsh or Gen Re, let's say they decided to say, you know what, I'm just going to go to one of my friends, friends. And let's call him a comic book character, Richie Rich. So he's an individual. And he goes to Richie Rich and says, you know what? I need some help in order to smooth my earnings. And I'd like to do some kind of insurance thing with you where I'm going to take your premiums, I'm going to insure them, I'm going to play this little scam. At the end of the day, we all know there's no risk here. You're going to wind up giving me $500 million in premiums. I'm going to pay off $500 million in claims, and I'm going to kick you another $5 million. So basically, it'll be the same thing, except we're taking Richie Rich in place of Jen Ree. Now what happens? The claim is exposed, and the various AIG shareholders are hurt, and they sue Hank Greenberg, as they're suing here, and that claim is sustained, and that moves forward. But who gets to sue Richie Rich? Well, under the vice chancellor's opinion, it says, well, his shareholders will do it. But he doesn't have shareholders. He's an individual. So we say, well, wait a minute. He aided and abetted. We can go after him. He was part of this whole scheme. Defendants here say, no, in pari delicto, and the vice chancellor buys into it. So now all of a sudden, those who want to stand in the shoes of AIG, they can't go after him. So who winds up being able to sue Richie Rich? The answer is nobody. So now what we're doing is we're encouraging people to say, here is a win-win situation. You should, if you're a wealthy individual and can do it, help companies by aiding and abetting the breaches of fiduciary duty. If you don't get caught, you get a lot of money. If you do get caught, you know what? You still get a lot of money and nobody can sue you. That can't possibly be the law of Delaware. And yet, under the vice chancellor's opinion, it would be. And until somebody can address how someone is going to sue that other person, that wealthy person who stands in the shoes now of, you know, in the same position as Jen Ree would be, I don't see how anyone can support the vice chancellor's opinion. Now, pari delicto was never supposed to eliminate aiding and abetting. Traditional in pari delicto is where two bank robbers come to court and say, gee, we had an agreement to split our haul 50-50, and my partner in crime took 60 and only left me 40. That's what in pari delicto was. And that makes sense for someone to say, why should the court and society spend its resources between two folks who violated the law? But that's not to say that it should cause innocent insiders, the corporation, the stockholders, all the employees, all those folks at AIG, from turning around and saying, we want to hold everyone responsible who caused us harm. Because the conspiracy here was not between AIG and someone else. It was between Hank Greenberg. It was between Smith. It was between Matthews. It was between Tizio and the other folks that they worked with. And to impute so that you say, well, it's really corporation and corporation, what you're doing is you're letting guilty people walk who will never have anyone to be able to get after them, because if they're not a public company, they don't have significant shareholders, they will never be sued. So we are not asking here for a division of ill-gotten gain. Rather, we're asking that all tortfeasors be responsible for their wrongdoing which caused damage to AIG. And it is the misconduct of knowingly aiding and abetting a faithless fiduciary that is sought to be addressed here. Not the misconduct of the fiduciary, but a conscious aiding and abetting where you have to have knowledge. That, it seems to me, is something that Delaware must not tolerate, and therefore cannot hold in pari delicto to knock out aiding and abetting. Seems to me the rule is very simple. One who contributes to the wrongdoing should not be allowed to invoke imputation. And I think that's pretty simple there, unless you have any questions.
Thank you.
Thanks.
May it please the Court, Fred Rowley, Jr., arguing on behalf of the third-party defendants. I think it's important to put the argument that Mr. Grant just made on the aiding and abetting exception that he proposes in context. The first important point is this is not an argument that was advanced in the Court of Chancery, as we explained in our briefs. the only reference to this new exception, and it would be a radical and a novel exception in terms of in peri delicto, or whether you look at it as an imputation exception. This argument was only made in passing in oral argument. It was not presented in the briefs. And given the novel nature of the exception, one would expect under traditional waiver rules that the party advancing that exception would articulate it in a clear fashion so that the court had an opportunity to actually address it. And that didn't happen below. So the first point is that it's waived. The second point is it's important to put in the substance of the exception.
Did the Vice Chancellor address it?
No, Justice Jacobs, he did not. He did not address it in his opinion. And given how thorough Vice Chancellor Strine's opinion was, one would have expected him to do that if he had had an opportunity to think about and consider this exception. But even considering it in its substance, it's important to note that this is not a classic case in which a party has asserted a claim for aiding and abetting the breach of a fiduciary duty. The plaintiff in this case is not a victim. The plaintiff is, on the face of the complaint, a party, a perpetrator of the alleged frauds, a party that is, if you accept plaintiff's own allegations, that is directly involved in both the reinsurance scheme and the bid rigging scheme. So it's not a classic case involving that cause of action. Even taking the smaller subset of derivative claims in which aiding and abetting the breach of a fiduciary duty is asserted, it's important to note that a lot of those claims would be able to go forward, because if what's alleged is that an outside defendant or an outside corporation aided and abetted an insider in directly harming the corporation, in looting it, in embezzling, if that outside corporation is alleged to have, for example, bribed the board of directors, in any of those scenarios, the adverse exception applies. You don't impute the misconduct of the insiders to the corporation. In peri delicto does not apply, and the case can go forward. That point is illustrated by the cases that plaintiffs cite. In cases like Carlson and in eBay, what was alleged was the usurpation of a corporate duty, and that you had these outside defendants who helped the insiders do that. And I believe in Carlson also you had an insider who was paying himself an exorbitant salary. That's the stuff of classic adverse interest. And in that situation, imputation wouldn't apply, in peri delicto wouldn't apply, and the case could go forward. So while
as we what's your view on Mr. Grant's example of the outsider being an individual?
Well, I think it goes back, part of it goes back to what Vice Chancellor Strine noted, which is that in this kind of situation, it's very important to treat the corporation, and in this case, the stockholders are acting, are standing in the shoes of the corporation the way that you would a natural person. And if you have two people who are both participants in a fraud on the face of the complaint, in peri delicto would apply. That's a classic in peri delicto situation.
Well, is there any recourse against the individual?
In the scenario that he outlined, as I understood it, all it was an insider at one corporation conspiring with another person who was not actually working for a corporation, if I understood the hypothetical correctly. Well, of course, as this case well illustrates, that person would probably be prosecuted. And Vice Chancellor Strine analyzed this and noted that public enforcement actions can have the kind of deterrent effect and can impose the kind of punishment that you would want to see in order to deter that kind of misconduct. And in this case, indeed, each of the corporations that are parties to this lawsuit have paid hefty fines and penalties. Many of the individuals who were actually involved in the alleged misconduct here, have been prosecuted by the United States. That is precisely why it is appropriate in this kind of scenario to allow the wrongdoing parties to stand where they are.
So your response to the hypothetical posed by Mr. Grant, namely that where the insiders of Corporation A are committing, let's say, fraudulent conduct, but they're conspiring with an individual that is a person rather than a company, the recourse against the individual would be through the criminal process, not through the civil liability process.
That's right, Your Honor, because as a matter of traditional law, this is just black-letter law, the insider's conduct is imputed to the corporation, so as a functional matter, you have two people who were involved in misconduct. Classic impera delicto situation, and under longstanding principles, as Vice Chancellor Stein noted, there's no societal benefit in engaging in an analysis of who won or lost in that conspiracy, in an accounting of the costs and benefits of the misconduct. And he went on to note that there would be adverse consequences for corporate governance principles if the court were to allow this suit to go forward, because, of course, we don't have individuals. They are outside defendant corporations, and the plaintiff in this suit is they are stockholders who, under traditional principles, stand in the shoes of AIG. And if the court were to allow this kind of case to go forward, it could undercut the integrity of corporations who ought to be treated as natural persons. And as the Vice Chancellor noted, you could dampen the incentive to hire good managers, to monitor them, to impose good corporate governance practices. All of these weigh in favor of applying imperi delicto here, in addition to the basic concern that you don't want courts engaged in this kind of analysis where you're trying to figure out who won and lost in this criminal conspiracy. And to get back to a question that was raised earlier, in this kind of context, if you were allow that suit to go forward, the court would necessarily have to second-guess the enforcement actions that have been brought, because part of what plaintiffs seek here is to recover the cost of the penalties that have been paid, the disgorgement that's been paid by AIG. And so you'd have to ask yourself, you'd have to second-guess whether the fines and penalties that have been paid by all these parties strike the appropriate balance, whether the settlement with, for example, between Gen Re and the SEC and the DOJ that was agreed to, and this isn't in the record because it was in January, whether that settlement imposes enough harm or whether some costs ought to be shifted. And that kind of analysis is simply not appropriate, as the Vice Chancellor noted, for a court. The better approach is simply to let the conspirators stand. If the court has no further questions.
Thank you. Mr. Grant, are you going to make your rebuttal at this time, or are we going to start with the other appellant? What's the plan?
I guess there wasn't a plan. I thought the appellants would all go, and I would, and then I guess counsel in the other case has a specific issue, and I thought after everyone went once, I'd come back. But if you would like to hear it on issue, I'm happy to come back in 2 minutes and address this.
Nope. I thought you'd had this all worked out.
Your Honors, Dan LaFalle of Paul Weiss for AIG. Just in case of any misunderstanding, I think that in the 451 appeal, we are now out of appellants. So if the appellant in the 574 appeal wants to present their arguments, I'd be happy to await that.
We're going to listen to whoever would like to speak until 3 o'clock, and then we're done.
Thank you, Your Honors. If it may it please the Court, first a matter of information. All the parties in the Marsh McLennan derivative suit in Fragnoli, except for the two aiding and abetting defendants, AIG and Maurice Greenberg, have entered into a stipulation of settlement, subject, of course, to court approval. Under the stipulation, AIG and Maurice Greenberg are not released parties. In our view, and others may have a different view, the proposed stipulation has no effect on the appeal. And I mention it as a matter of information, and I apologize that until last night I hadn't realized that we had not advised the court of this.
This is something that's pending in the Court of Chancery separately. Is that correct?
That's correct.
Okay. Very well. Thank you.
I'd like to focus on the only two issues that are unique to our appeal, and not argued by other litigants. The first is our response to defendant Hank Greensburg's contention that we did not state an aiding and abetting claim in our complaint. Indeed, we did. Their argument is ingenious and it's seductive. Mr. Greensburg argues that one cannot knowingly abet a failure of oversight claim. Of course, the four elements of aiding and abetting are a fiduciary relationship, breach of that relationship, a non-fiduciary knowingly participated in the breach, and damages. And the serious challenge is to number three, that the non-fiduciary knowingly participated, that Mr. Greensburg knowingly participated in the Marsh insiders' breach of their fiduciary duty to Marsh. The problem with that contention is that we made a lot more claims than a Caremark claim in this case, and those claims were specifically sustained. We indeed pled a Caremark claim and had it sustained over a motion to dismiss, but we pled a lot more, and 13 of our defendants of 21 individual defendants were either directors and officers of Marsh McLennan or were just officers of Marsh McLennan. The Vice Chancellor indeed found pleading stage inferences that all 13 officers, including Marsh McLennan CEO Jeffrey Greensburg, Hank Greensburg's son, had knowledge of the wrongdoing at Marsh McLennan. He found the complaint includes particularized instances of Mr. Greensburg directing negotiations with Marsh. It's at paragraph 139 of the complaint. And the Vice Chancellor found in both decisions a pleading stage inference that he knew of and participated in them based on the fact that all three co-conspirators, Marsh, Ace, and AIG, were run by Greensburgs. The CEOs of all three companies were Greensburgs, Hank Greensburg and his two sons, Jeffrey and Evan. The transcript at 110-111 as to the Greensburg family discusses that inference. Later at page 121 of the transcript, the Vice Chancellor says, this shows that this mattered, that the CEO of AIG would be involved. Thus, Hank Greensburg's, you can't abet a Caremark claim, just doesn't hold water because it's factual. The factual grounding for it is incorrect. Before I move on to the second issue, do the justices have any questions about that one? The second is our core contention that both appeals, being mirror images of one another, should be decided the same way. We urge the court either to reverse both or to affirm both. There's no principled reason why the two cases should not be decided the same way. And I don't think any party, and certainly not the Vice Chancellor, indicates that there should be. Marsh McLennan is the object of derivative plaintiff's trust. And as derivative plaintiffs, we must advocate what is best for Marsh. Clearly, the sort of tallying up of accounts among wrongdoers, corporate individual, master and servant, cannot be in Marsh's best interest. They were out of the AIG derivative case, and they should stay out, even if that means not toting up AIG's and Hank Greensburg's liability to Marsh. However, we don't have a monopoly on wisdom. If this court disagrees, and that's why we lodged this appeal, I think the record is very clear that we were reluctant appellants. If this court disagrees and reinstates the suit against Marsh, then this court should prevent a one-sided accounting between wrongdoers where only one side's damages count, only one side can win, like a game of one-on-one basketball where only one side is allowed to score. The in pari delicto defense has always had a strong element of discretion. It's not a per se rule, and we hope the Vice Chancellor's opinion doesn't change that. Viewed as such, we believe that the court has the power to do justice and affirm both decisions, or at the very least, not reverse one and affirm the other. Let me address just for a moment how the court might arrive at that position. AIG argues, as we understand it, that should in pari delicto not be applied to the situation, and should an exception be carved out, as Mr. Grant suggests, that's the end of in pari delicto. And Mr. Grant, on behalf of the very same company, AIG, argues that if an exception like that is not carved out, that's the end of aiding and abetting. We submit that the court has more discretion than that, and that Vice Chancellor Strine's opinion does not mean to undercut the traditional discretionary basis for applying in pari delicto and its twin unclean hands. And to illustrate this point, I want to go to the two decisions that Vice Chancellor Strine has written on this subject, AIG, the subject to one of these appeals, and HealthSouth, which every single brief in these consolidated appeals has cited. I count six exceptions. I think the reports of the death of in pari delicto on the one hand and reports of the death of aiding and abetting on the other hand, as Mark Twain said about reports of his own death, are premature. I count six exceptions spelled out in these two decisions. The insider exception. An insider cannot assert in pari delicto to shield himself from the consequences of his own wrongdoing. Everybody accepts that. Vice Chancellor Strine quite correctly spelled out a gatekeeper exception, that an auditor, counsel for a compliance committee, possibly a banker who has the function of an inside advisor, that's my extension of it, is a gatekeeper and therefore is an exception to the rule. That's asserted in AIG but not HealthSouth. The insider exception is asserted in both. The policy exception, that the judge sitting on one of these cases can look at the case and decide that public policy in favor of reaching the merits overrides any consideration of in pari delicto. A lot of discretion there. The adverse interest exception, I think it's too narrowly defined in Vice Chancellor Strine's opinion. Total abandonment, I don't think it need be that narrow. Then there's one in the HealthSouth case that did not make it into the AIG decision. Self-interest in concealing information. If the fiduciary has self-interest in concealing the information from his own board, his own shareholders, that, according to the HealthSouth decision, is an exception to in pari delicto, a motive to conceal. And mentioned in the AIG decision is duress, possibly the least important of the six. Now, with these six, I don't think either in pari delicto is dead if you go one way, Your Honors. And I don't think that aiding and abetting is dead if the court goes the other way. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. DePrima.
May it please the court, Dan LaFalle of Paul Weiss for AIG. I join in all of the arguments that Mr. Rowley presented on behalf of Gen Re and the other defendants, the other appellees in the AIG case, and I will try to avoid repeating what he said. There is one point, though, on which I think perhaps a little more elaboration would be helpful to the court, and that is the question posed by the court as to Mr. Grant's hypothetical in which Hank Greenberg, as I understand it, conspires not with executives of Gen Re, but with Richie Rich. And the question is, does Mr. Richie Rich get off scot-free, and who's left to sue him? And the answer, part of the answer, of course, is the administrative and criminal process. But part of the answer also is the victims of the tort. If Mr. Greenberg conspires with Richie Rich in order to smooth earnings by engaging in untraditional insurance practices, then at least in the real world, the reason he was trying to do that, allegedly, was to affect AIG's stock price. And people who buy AIG's stock in the public market have standing to sue both AIG and Mr. Greenberg, as well as Richie Rich, or in the real world, Jen Ree. It may not surprise this court to learn that that has happened, and that there is a federal securities class action pending in the Southern District of New York right now, as we speak, and it's been pending there for a number of years, in which exactly that claim has been asserted against AIG, against Mr. Greenberg, and against Richie Rich, or Mr. Raleigh's client, Jen Ree. It is, in fact, it's on the public record. It's no secret that Mr. Raleigh's client has entered into a settlement agreement in that case, in which they are going to pay, is the number public? Many tens of millions of dollars. And if that were not Jen Ree, but were an individual named Richie Rich, there's no distinction at all. Mr. Rich would be paying those tens of millions of dollars as well, assuming he had them to pay. So Mr. Grant's example was, I think, fallacious. And it was fallacious in a way that points up the central element of confusion in the appellant's position. And I think if I could turn to the record in the 574 appeal and to the plaintiff's allegations in the Marsh case, I can underscore and highlight why that's the case. The alleged wrongdoing in this case consisted of a scheme in which insurers paid Marsh contingent commissions, and those contingent commissions increased based on the amount of business that Marsh sent to the insurers. And obviously that created a conflict of interest insofar as Marsh is supposedly the agent of the insurance purchaser. And as alleged in the complaint, those contingent commissions and that conflict were not disclosed to the customers. And in some instances, bid rigging was allegedly involved. In this context, it is not Marsh that is the victim of the scheme. It is the customers. In fact, far from being a victim, the complaint alleges that Marsh received $3 billion in undisclosed contingent commissions. And that's in the complaint at paragraph 106 at A89 of the appellant's appendix. That constituted somewhere over 30% of their earnings over the relevant period. That is not victimization. In fact, the aiding and abetting alleged in this case consisted of payments by AIG to Marsh, not bribes paid to a disloyal fiduciary of Marsh, but to Marsh, and Marsh collected $3 billion. The only personal benefit to the disloyal fiduciaries at Marsh was derivative of the benefit to Marsh, as alleged in the complaint at least, through enhanced compensation deriving from the enhanced revenues to Marsh. And that's in the complaint, paragraph 18, at A53 of the appendix. These facts, which are not in dispute, they're in the complaint, distinguish this case markedly from those in which the courts have permitted aiding and abetting claims to go forward. In those cases, as Mr. Rowley said, and I'll beg the court's indulgence if I repeat briefly here, the fiduciary was directly victimizing the corporation by stealing money from it. In those circumstances, there is no basis to impute the disloyal fiduciary's knowledge or actions to the corporation. In our case, where the corporation was the beneficiary in the first instance of the wrongdoing, that is the classic case where imputation applies. And in fact, no one disputes that for purposes of the basic liability to the customers, Marsh's the activities of Marsh's executives is properly imputed to Marsh. Indeed, and this is sort of a point that sort of ties all of this together, the very injury that the plaintiffs are trying to recover on behalf of Marsh in this case is injury that accrued to Marsh solely by virtue of the very imputation that they are now trying to avoid. It is only because the executives who engaged in this scheme can have their conduct and knowledge attributed to Marsh that Marsh has any injury at all. The injury consisted principally of an $850 million payment to the New York Attorney General. If the activities of the executives were not imputable to Marsh, the New York Attorney General would have had no basis for suing Marsh, and Marsh certainly would not have coughed up $850 million. So what we have here is a situation where Marsh has suffered injury by virtue of traditional agency principles of imputation. It is seeking to sue AIG, again, by the way, through traditional agency principles of imputation. Remember, it is the conduct of AIG's executives, not of AIG as distinct from its executives, that they're trying to base their claim on. So the injury resulted by way of imputation. The lawsuit is based on imputation, but the plaintiffs would have traditional notions of imputation ignored only with respect to Marsh as a plaintiff. And I would submit that that kind of picking and choosing, which is unprecedented in the law, is a very, very dangerous road to go down. They have provided no reason why the customary rules should not apply as they applied to give rise to the liability in the first place. In fact, having gotten $3 billion in undisclosed contingent commissions, it really doesn't sit right as a matter of equity that Marsh should be able to go after someone else now to recover the $850 million, the 25% or so of that benefit that it paid out in penalties. In fact, on the facts of this case, this is a poster child for in pari delicto. Marsh and AIG each settled with the New York Attorney General. They each independently assessed the law and the evidence, guided by capable counsel, and they reached settlements that they considered fair and the New York Attorney General considered fair. Marsh paid $850 million, AIG paid $475 million. If these cases proceed, then the task of the Vice Chancellor in the court below will be to allocate the penalties, these penalties, the $850 and the $475, to reallocate them among the wrongdoers. And that is exactly what in pari delicto is designed to avoid. And in fact, the appellant's brief below makes it clear that that's exactly what they want to achieve. At A218 of the appendix through 219, public policy would be served to reach the case on the merits to determine relative responsibility for the wrongdoing as between the fiduciaries at Marsh and MMC, the parent company on the one hand, and AIG or Hank Greenberg on the other. That could be a paraphrase from the precedents that tell you the courts are not supposed to do that, and that's why we have in pari delicto, that so that the courts will not get into a dispute between wrongdoers about who should bear the cost. Finally, a note on this idea that derivative suits are somehow different. The idea that the stockholders are innocent and that they are suffering because of their faithless fiduciaries proves too much, because the stockholders are just as innocent when the board decides to bring a lawsuit. So the exception that the plaintiff is asking for is logically inconsistent. It essentially, what they are asking for is a rule that in pari delicto should not apply whenever there is an innocent principal who is imputed with wrongdoing because of a disloyal fiduciary. That, I submit, would eat up and entirely eliminate the in pari delicto defense for actions by corporations. As to the idea that applying in pari delicto would eliminate aiding and abetting, I think we've already demonstrated that that's not the case for the traditional case where a disloyal fiduciary embezzles or directly victimizes the corporation. Finally,
your time's concluded. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Please the court, John Gardner for Mr. Greenberg in the Marsh-Mack case. Your Honors, there is no good reason at all why the in pari delicto doctrine does not apply in the Marsh-Mack case. The allegations of the complaint could not be clearer that in this particular case, it was a business plan of Marsh McLennan to engage in market service agreements. Not only were the executives of Marsh aware of that, but as pled, the board of directors was aware of it or failed its oversight function in not being aware of it and failed to put into place adequate controls. In the Marsh case, you have no question about whether or not the knowledge should be imputed to the corporation. And I'm not going to go back over what learned counsel have already said, but this case is, in fact, the poster child where Marsh itself has, through its derivative plaintiffs, has pled its own culpable wrongdoing. And indeed, that's why Marsh's counsel has acknowledged in standing before you candidly that, in fact, Marsh believes that impari delicto applies here. And in fact, Marsh as a corporation in the prior case is saying that impari delicto applies here. It's somewhat Twilight Zone-ish to somehow think that Marsh as an entity is not acting directly when it says impari delicto applies and acting derivatively in saying, actually, we also think it applies. Mr. De Prima has said he thinks impari delicto applies here, but somehow it gets thrown out the window because it's a derivative case. There's no law that I'm aware of that says just because it's a derivative case, somehow they get a do-over. And indeed, Mr. De Prima's six exceptions to impari delicto, not one of them could possibly apply in the Marsh Mac case. I don't think I need to trot back down them unless you want to hear them again, but not one of those six could possibly apply on the facts that have been alleged by Marsh in this case. So this is indeed a poster child case. The only issue, therefore, that I will address is this Richie Rich comment that isn't in this case. I don't want there to be any confusion that that's not in this case. What Mr. Grant is talking about is the AIG case, and he's using a hypothetical in that case. In this particular case, the allegations as pled are that AIG, whose CEO was Mr. Greenberg, aided and abetted Marsh, which admits its culpability, in a market services agreement and bid rigging scheme. That's classic impari delicto. In fact, I was here for the first argument where Mr. Grant tried to distinguish impari delicto by saying this isn't the classic case where both of them are equally wrong when he was talking about AIG and PwC. Well, the Marsh case is the classic case where, as pled, at a minimum, Marsh is far more culpable than either AIG or Mr. Greenberg. And unless your honors have questions about that, I'll leave it at that. With respect to what Mr. De Prima said was the only other issue is that the lower court did not reach and did not rule that an adequate aiding and abetting claim had been stated against Mr. Greenberg. And we've submitted in our papers that your honors can affirm on that additional ground because on the facts as pled, there is not an adequate aiding and abetting claim stated against Mr. Greenberg. They do not, and they seem to be abandoning the idea that Mr. Greenberg could be aiding and abetting a Caremark violation by their independent directors. But they don't, if they abandon that, what they're actually saying is Mr. Greenberg somehow aided and abetted the non-disclosure element that Marsh itself chose. There's no direct link between their allegations that Mr. Greenberg did something and Marsh's decision taken at the executive level and at the board level not to disclose the conflict of interest that their own business plan gave rise to when they chose to use market service agreements. So on two bases, in my respectful submission, Mr. Greenberg, the court should be affirmed on impari delicto, and if this court has any doubt about that, in this case, the Marsh case, there is not an adequately pled aiding and abetting claim against Mr. Greenberg. Thank you.
Thank you.
Your Honors, like Mr. Gardner, I am a little concerned that there could be confusion and that everything that Mr. Gardner said, Mr. De Prima said, and that Mr. Revelle said about, you know, the specifics of the case has to do with not my case, has to do with Marsh's case. And I think that there are enough factual differences that one could decide to reverse in ours and affirm in theirs. So I don't want that confused. But I would like to address some of the more general points that Mr. Revelle made, which are just plain wrong. He said, you know what, the people who bought stock, they're the ones who could go after civilly in my example, Richie Rich. That was his big answer, that, you know, the aider and abettor, they go after him. Just didn't read a couple of Supreme Court cases. Central Bank of Denver, there is no cause of action under the federal securities laws for aiding and abetting. Black letter, United States Supreme Court rule. So that wipes that one out. The other thing was a case that Mr. Gardner's partner argued, I think it was Dabbitt, Mr. Kasner would be very upset if we didn't mention that, that there's no standing for shareholders, for holders, to sue under the securities laws. In other words, you have to be a purchaser or a seller. That goes back to Blue Chip Stamp, but it was reiterated in I believe the case was Dabbitt. So no one has provided the answer, what happens to Richie Rich? Because I think the answer is he walks away scot-free. Now, there was a comment that says, well, the criminal process will get after him. But Delaware law has never relied solely on whether the criminal process is implicated or not. That's just not our civil law. And this would not be the right case to put it in. So the fact that an individual might be prosecuted, first of all, I'm not familiar with any prosecution for someone aiding and abetting a breach of fiduciary duty. I don't think that, I don't know who would go prosecute that, but I'm just not familiar with it. I will say there is, I have seen criminal prosecution recently for aiding and abetting a securities fraud, but as I said, there is no civil action for that, and I think there's a big difference. The other comment that was made was that if we allow aiding and abetting because we don't allow in pari delicto, that will somehow damper the incentive to hire good, honest managers. I just, that rings hollow. Someone's going to say, I'll tell you what, we can hire this honest person over here or this dishonest one there. Gee, let's check and see if there's in pari delicto or not because I really want to hire the dishonest one. I mean, it's just bizarre. I mean, that's just not what happens. But there is a lot of incentive if you're the individual and you say, there is no civil liability for me to try to help out my buddy here and help him, you know, pull off this breach of fiduciary duty. There is no civil liability for me. And criminal liability is extraordinarily rare in there. There is incentive to do that. And let's not forget, there are individuals in this case. This is not simply a corporation versus corporation case. There are lots of individuals that we're going after. Some have been prosecuted. Most have not. They will walk away scot-free if there is in pari delicto and no aiding and abetting. The point that, we didn't dwell on it enough in oral argument, I think we quote on page 2 of our reply brief, and part of the problem, the reason this keeps coming up, is, you know, in the trial court, we got, I think, about 400 pages of briefs of every defect we had known to mankind with our complaint. And so we have to respond to all of them. And so we do respond to all of them. But obviously in responding to all of them, you don't spend vast amounts of time. By the time you get to this court, the issues are narrowed. Here's the one or two legal issues that we're appealing on. We spend more time. But in oral argument, I said, and I quote, and this is at the appendix 916 to 917, and I tell the chancellor, the vice chancellor, when it comes to the aiding and abetting claim, in pari delicto is irrelevant because by definition, if you aided and abetted someone who is committing a crime or wrongdoing, you couldn't have pari delicto. In other words, we discussed that issue. So that issue was in front of him. Now, he chose to look at it as a corporation versus corporation. He didn't choose to look at it as the Richie Rich example. I do concede that I didn't raise the Richie Rich example with him. Had we narrowed on that one issue, might I have? Yes. But, you know, we were dealing with 2 days' worth of argument on what had to be 20 or 30 different issues. And I think the case law is clear, the General Motors versus King case, that, you know, if it's raised in argument in the court below, that that's sufficient. The last thing, and it's actually the only legitimate point that I think I heard from my friends on the other side, was the damage question. That what you're asking the court to do here is that other authorities have made decisions to settle cases, whether they be administrative, civil, or criminal cases, and they've agreed as to what the proportion should be. And they say what the vice chancellor would have to do is kind of reassess that. And I would agree that that would be problematic. But the question is, how do you deal with that issue? Now, One way to deal with it is the extreme way, the baby in bathwater, and say, well, in that case, you don't have a claim, and we're going to get rid of aiding and abetting because this could be an issue. I say that that's using, you know, a sledgehammer when a, you know, a surgical knife can be used instead. And a rule that says criminal fines don't get reallocated is not unreasonable. I mean, one could go back and in the Court of Chancery could say, look, I'm going to listen to this, but as a matter of law, I'm going to say when you're seeking for damages, I'm not reallocating criminal fines. But there are lots and lots of other damages, like the cost of having to go through restatements because of things that weren't really insurance, of the investigations, of all these other things. There's hundreds and hundreds of millions of dollars of damages other than criminal fines, and either other than administrative fines. And I think you could carve out administrative and criminal fines and say, as a damage rule, that doesn't work. But all the other damages we should be discussing. And so if their sole objection to, well, you're going to have to do this is interfering with other sovereign bodies, I don't think the court has to do that. But there's a very narrow way of doing that rather than the extraordinary way. I think those are the only points I wanted to raise, unless any of your honors have any questions.
Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honors.
Mr. DePrima, do you have anything you'd like to add?
Yes, I thought I had used up all my time, but...
Well, you have a few seconds. We'll give you a couple of minutes.
All right, I just want to zero in on one of what I count as the six exceptions in the AIG and HealthSouth cases, because I think it's extremely important that if Your Honors write a red line rule on in pari delicto, that this exception be included in it. Where an individual has self-interest in concealing information from his own board, imputation, and therefore in pari delicto, should not apply. I think that may be the answer to the Richie Rich hypothetical. If the corporation has an faithless insider who conspires with an individual on the other side, the faithless insider, if he has an incentive to conceal that information from his own board, then imputation shouldn't narrow aiding and abetting in the first place. Imputation should not give rise to an impari delicto defense in the first place. Now, I say this because, again, our only position here is that we want to be sure that the Vice Chancellor's opinion is viewed in a way that enables the court to find a way to reverse both or to affirm both. Thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you. Thank you all. The briefing in this case was very helpful, and so were the arguments today. And the court will take this matter under advisement, and we will also adjourn.
Bye.